You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Lucky for us, Alina stuck it out doing what she really wanted to do, singing, and lucky for us, she was discovered by Farrar Straus editor-in-chief Eric Chinsky on Pandora. It's a great story. He just called her up out of the blue and asked if she'd done any essay writing. So lucky for us, tonight we celebrate her debut book, You Must Go and Win, which is released at the same time as her new album, Make Your Own Danger. So she's going to read from her new book and sing us some songs from her new album. And we're also very fortunate to have as interlocutor tonight Eric J. Lawrence, who is KCRW's music librarian, and he's known for his encyclopedic knowledge of music, ranging from the latest acts of classic TV themes and other criminally overlooked tunes, hidden gems, and guilty pleasures. His show is on every Sunday night, 12 to 3 a.m., and he already knew Alina Simone's music when I called KCRW to look for a likely suspect. And in addition, he works as a librarian at the Beverly Hills Public Library, so how cool is that? There may be a few people in this audience who remember a number of years ago when Patti Smith played an acoustic set, and she's another great writer, songwriter, so those who were there will remember, and I think those of you who are here tonight will long remember Alina Simone. Please welcome her and Eric J. Lawrence. Thank you.
Good evening. So I'm going to read two brief sections from my book. My book is sort of split into two themes. So there's about four or five essays about my family, which is a little bit unusual. Louise already kind of explained my background. My father was a political refugee. My mother was a political refugee because she was married to him. He was blacklisted by the KGB because he refused recruitment when he was in college. And this first chapter of my book is about a communist newspaper contacting me for an interview after a Russian language album I released caught their interest. So I got this email out of nowhere from a journalist for Komsomolska Pravda, the Komsomol Truth. And I got very excited about doing this interview because nobody from my hometown of Kharkov, Ukraine, had ever contacted me. So I went to my parents very excited, like, oh, this is so exciting. And they were so not excited, it's not even funny. So, or maybe it is. All right. So I'm just going to read a few pages from this first chapter. In late September 2008, I received an email from one El Monstro with the subject line, "Hello, Alina, Kharkov on the line." El Monstro's real name, it turned out, was Kirill, and he was a journalist for the Kharkov bureau of the newspaper Komsomolska Pravda, which he translated for me as Komsomol True. He had learned that I was born in Kharkov and wanted to interview me about my new album, a collection of songs covering the Soviet punk singer Yanka Diaghileva. "If we'll please you," Kirill wrote, "reveal to us all news about your creation." It was the first time that anyone from the Ukrainian city where I was born had ever taken an interest in my music, and I was surprised, a little touched even. My family had left the Soviet Union as political refugees when I was too young to remember, but sometimes I felt it anyway. A Kharkov-shaped hole in my heart. Not to mention that the motherland had come calling when I was feeling particularly homeless, having just moved from North Carolina to a temporary sublet in Brooklyn. My new apartment occupied the top floor of an old brownstone that was badly in need of repair. The closet doors were lying in a heap on the floor when I arrived, and there were holes the size of hand grenades beneath the rotted windowsills. Spinning the hot water tap in the shower felt like placing an outside bet on a roulette wheel. And the water didn't emerge from the shower head so much as the wall, like it was some kind of life-giving rock. I would press myself against the runoff in the mornings before the tiles could suck away what little remained of its warmth. It was the kind of place that made you think too much about your station in life, your dimming prospects. If nothing else, I figured, an interview with Komsomol True could serve as a pleasant distraction from speed dialing the 3 phone numbers my landlady had given me for her possibly imaginary handyman. We left Kharkiv because my father was blacklisted by the KGB, but whenever I asked why, Papa always replied that he'd never know for sure. Did I think he just received a form letter in the mail one day on KGB stationery that began, "We regret to inform you," and ended with a neat summary of his transgressions? If provoked further, he'd always end up demurring, "Don't make me out to be some kind of dissident freedom fighter," then retreat to a yellow legal pad full of equations. He refused to romanticize our flight from the Soviet Union, to let me imagine it as some kind of action-adventure movie from the 80s. "It's not like I ever slayed a stormtrooper," his warning glance seemed to say, "or breakdanced my way to freedom." Papa did admit, however, that it probably had something to do with turning the KGB down when they made him a recruitment offer in college. In any case, it was soon afterward that bad things insisted on happening to my family. My father's military health exemption, he'd had polio as a child, was revoked without warning, and instead of serving in the officer corps, like most college graduates, he was sent off to work in the notoriously brutal building brigades of the Soviet Army, alongside violent criminals. My mother was forced to quit her job and was mysteriously unable to find work, despite graduating with top honors from the state university. Unemployment was officially illegal, but she stayed home with me in the flat we shared with my father's parents and sister, while Papa drifted through a string of menial jobs, rarely lasting long at any of them. So I'm going to skip a little bit forward to this, the email that I got from the journalist. Kirill wrote to me in a dialect of English that might best be described as Google Translate on acid. "Hello, Alina. I was pleasantly surprised when got a rapid answer from you. Very interestingly, me with you to communicate. Our musicians stick to very with self-confidence, and journalists are not loved. I am a rad that you are quite another man. If you will not object, I prepared questions by which I and our readers able to know you better. Here list of questions." Though feeling a bit damaged by the tilt-a-whirl quality of Kirill's prose, I moved on to the questions themselves and found that they fell into exactly 3 equally irritating categories. The first consisted of questions that I couldn't understand at all. At the top of this list was, "Do you have any zunes?" This is spelled Z-O-O-N-S. I had no idea what a zune was, having spent much of the past 8 years surrounded by indie rock guys whose favorite intimidation tactic always began, "You've seriously never heard of insert Yesterminute's most popular band here?" The zune threw me into a small panic. I was convinced it was some really cool Ukrainian thing, the measure by which my own coolness would be judged. It was bad enough worrying about my relative coolness in one country without exposing myself to the judgment of zune-loving Ukrainian hipsters. I didn't think I had any, but regardless, decided it was safer to politely ignore this one. The second category consisted of questions that I technically could answer, but very much preferred not to. This list included questions like, "Are you very beautiful?" "Did not you think about the career of movie actor?" "Why exactly fate, considered that it is not quite womanish employment?" "Do you like to cook? Who you on the sign of the zodiac?" "Did not you have a desire to engage in physics? Do you watch after that takes place now in Ukraine? Do you want to arrive to Kharkiv with concerts?" The last category of questions, I had to admit, were best answered by my parents themselves. These included, "Where lived? Where walked in child's garden, in school? In what age you were driven away from Kharkiv? What now do your parents get busy?" "I hope on a collaboration," Kirill wrote before signing off with his regards, "and will be with impatience." Although my parents clearly were refusing to drink the Kool-Aid, I decided to forward the questions to them anyway, pointing out which ones they might answer if they had the time. Minutes later, I received the following response from my mother. "Alina, could you please stop this collaboration, for God's sake? I cannot read this nonsense anymore. This is pure delirium. M." My father's one-line response was, "I am a rad," in Kirill's message. And that was it. Neither of them answered the questions or so much as implied that they would. But the next day, there was a message from my mother with an attachment labeled early childhood and a note that said, "Alina, here's a template for all inquiries of this kind. You should keep it for the future and use cut and paste for the next idiot from Comsomol True. M. Then, despite Mama's professed ambivalence about my interview, I received another message from her within 20 minutes when I failed to respond instantaneously to the first one. Is this all? That much for your feedback. In any case, please don't forget to bring the kitchen knives for me. Please put them in your luggage right now, M. I opened the attachment. These are unedited emails from my mother, by the way. She's like co-author of my book now. I opened the attachment and found that my mother had conveniently decided to write her history of my early childhood from my first-person perspective. I left Kharkiv at the age of 1 year. To preschool, I never did go. This was unnecessary because my mother was forced to take leave of her job by her own volition, or rather that of her supervisor. In this fashion, she was able to stay home with me. My father was a night watchman. He guarded the kiosk next to the Concert Hall Ukraina in Shevchenko Park. The kiosk was called Cafe Lyra. Port wine was sold there and candies as well, probably as a snack for after drinking port wine. Besides this, there was nothing to guard in the kiosk. Papa was given a job there with the hope that he would drink less than the other watchmen, and this hope was fully realized. One day, my papa had a stroke of good fortune. He was offered a job moonlighting as a night watchman at the zoo, which was located nearby. In this fashion, he could guard two locations simultaneously, but this happiness was short-lived. He lasted only a month and a half before someone filed an anonymous report against him, revealing that he had a higher education. The director of the zoo did not want any trouble, and Papa was fired. From time to time, my parents were summoned by the KGB for a chat. There, they were given the never-changing standard question, "What is the real reason that you are leaving the country?" To which they would give the standard response, "To reunite with our relatives," and then something or other about the humane policies of the party and the government. After these fruitful exchanges, they were usually told, "Wait, we will notify you," and then everything would repeat itself. So, how are we doing on time? Should I sing? I'm fine. Okay, I'm gonna read a section of from a music essay. So, some of you might have heard of Craigslist. I think you have that in LA, and. When I first moved to New York City to become a singer, I didn't know anyone, and so I did what, you know, what a lot of people do. I made my first mistake, and that was to get on Craigslist, and so this is about, you know, being a very down and out musician, hoping for a chance, and getting on Craigslist, trying to connect with some other like-minded souls, and make some beautiful music. There were no misspellings, no horrible questions. Are you the complete package? Do you have unique cutting-edge talent and the follow-through it takes to succeed? No inscrutable requirements. Must have full head of hair or no hair at all. No pent-up rage. Oh, can I swear? Is there? Oh, it's awesome. So awesome. Fuck whiners, egomaniacs, and slackers. If you aren't 150% serious about making this band a full-time gig, then go sit on your fucking finger and rotate. No scamming. Raw, slick, fast, slow, lo-fi, no-fi, hipster, retro, old-school, post-punk, neo-soul. I will fill in your blank, rock star. After months of looking for bands on Craigslist, it was a relief to find the producer. A professional who also happened to meet my minimum standard of being sane, polite, and competent. His ad was vague, mentioning only that he was looking for a female singer to collaborate on a new album, but I noticed that he hadn't used the word collab, nor did he make any wild flag-raising claims. Still, I had to admit the thing that appealed to me most here was that a producer, as opposed to a mere bandmate, had power. Something I lacked, something no one else I knew had any of either. True? I had never worked with one or even met one, but I imagined a producer to be something like the Thomas Cook of the rock world, riding the rough seas of Craigslist to unearth raw talent, returning to lay treasure at the feet of Tommy Mottola and David Geffen. At the very least, his Soho address inspired confidence. It felt like cheating, but I craved a shortcut. Casual encounters of the musical kind had come to dominate my nights and weekends, trapping me in a surreal game of speed dating with a cast of similarly damaged and desperate people. Why were the people I met through Craigslist in New York so different from the easygoing musicians I'd played with when I lived in Austin, the ones I'd found by going to record stores and putting up flyers just like a medieval person? The people answering my ads now were always the lifers, the ones who used Craigslist as a verb. I've been Craigslisting for over a year now, one potential bassist exhaled down into his coffee. How about you? And I realized that our meetup had suddenly transformed into an AA meeting, minus the hard chairs. Then there was the rockabilly guitar player who dressed like Elvis and left a trail of cologne in his wake strong enough to disinfect my bathroom, and the girl whose musical taste never predated whatever band had played the Bowery Ballroom the previous night. There was the pale, slumpy guy who hated his tech job working for a financial services firm and doomed every sentence with the preface, "As soon as I get my shit together." Not to mention the series of dismal encounters that led to the discovery New Jersey's home to a cult of male lawyers obsessed with Jeff Buckley. I was ready for all this to end. So when I heard back from the producer, I felt more than the usual cheap pick-me-up of knowing my credentials had checked out. We agreed to meet up at his space the following Tuesday, and I spent the rest of the week deleting people from my inbox and feeling happy about it. The studio was in one of those expensive and painfully maintained Manhattan buildings that always look wholly deserted. It was raining the morning of my audition, and I'd made the unfortunate decision to eat a croissant along the way, only to notice once I reached the door that it had flaked down the front of my black jacket. I pawed at myself uselessly for a moment, realized it was hopeless, then rang the buzzer for the second floor. Within a moment, the speaker crackled and a clipped male voice came at me. "Is this my 11 o'clock?" "Yes? Are you the Ricky Lee Jones one or the Annie Lennox one?" Sorry? Second flop. Then the door sang its flat note and there was nothing left to do but open it. As I stood inside the doorway, wondering what to make of this exchange, a familiar sensation began to creep over me. Let's call it hope slippage. The quick drop of pressure when oversized expectations are ratcheted down violently and without warning. "This is going to be bad," a voice inside my head whispered. "Run away while you still can." But I didn't run. I went upstairs, feeling grateful that at least the hallway wasn't mirrored. The producer was sitting in an Aeron chair, backlit by an enormous Mac screen. When he got up to greet me, I noticed that he was strikingly good-looking. John Edwardsy haircut, belted black pants, and a long-sleeved shirt whose color could best be described as expensive. Everything in the studio looked very modern and new. A 24-channel mixing board without a spot of dust amongst its matrix of knobs, a sleek desk made of dark wood, a side table with a neat stack of tape-op back issues. "Helena," he said, looking down at the list in his hand. "Alina." "Well, Alina, it must really be throwing it down out there," he said with a nod at my dripping guitar case. "I forget, did you ever email me that list of influences? I think I mentioned Sinead O'Connor." "Right," he said. He was British, but I can't do that accent very well. Making some notes on his list. "So then you must be the Sinead O'Connor one." I said, finding it surprisingly difficult to push the words, "I am the Sinead O'Connor one," out of my mouth. "Why don't you go over there and set up while I finish some things?" The producer pointed to the back wall where a Marshall stack waited on a square of lintless carpet. "No problem," I said, and felt it again, that small drowning sensation. Okay. That's amazing how you switch. Oh, wait, no, I'm still in the, you're going to turn this off and turn that on. Yes? Oh. Sorry. So little time. Okay, so I'm going to play, actually, a Russian song. I'm going to play a song from that, the album that first interested Kirill, the Ukrainian journalist. So it's a cover of a Soviet punk song. by the singer Yanka Diaghileva.
От большого ума лишь с ума до тюрьма. От лихой головы лишь к новой рвы. От красивой души только струпья и вши. От вселенской любви только морды в крови. Простыни на ветру, пороси по утру. От бесплодных идей до бесплодных гостей. Открытых столов до пробитых голов. От закрытых дверей до зарытых зверей. Спасет, он нам покой принесет. Под шершавым крылом ночь за круглым столом. Заводи самокат.
Ah, 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 ah.
gonna bring it. sorry, my guitars are a little out of tune. I just got off a plane, so I'm trying to control the madness. Everyone always asks, so this is called a strum stick. And it is a mountain dulcimer built like a guitar. And this song is called My Love is a Mountain, and it's one I wrote. It's from my new album.
Thank you.
Eric?
Congratulations on both the book and the new record. I will say it is true that I first had the pleasure to encounter you and your music at a music festival in Athens, Georgia. And we were trying to figure this out. I think it was 2007. So, you know, little did I know that I would be here sharing a stage with you here at a library.
True.
sharing some water in some allowed mugs here, discussing the book that you've written. And I want to start off by sort of asking a little more of a story about how the book came to be. And I kind of want to frame it from the perspective of, you know, the two artistic endeavors, the music world and the book world, and how I think there's similarities, and one of the key similarities is that there's sort of a traditional way to do things and sort of a non-traditional way to do things. And certainly in the music industry, the traditional way is get signed to a label and have them put your record out and tour and get played on the radio and become a huge star. The non-traditional way is aided by technology now, where you can literally just record stuff in your own bedroom and you know, pick an image and make a CD cover, burn some CDs, send it out that way, or just put it up online. And similarly, with books, the traditional way, of course, you get a publisher and get your book published, but there's other things you can do, too, in a non-traditional way. Self-publish, or these days, again, with technology, blogging is a way. You know, some people have made a name for themselves as writers, as bloggers. But your book does not betray the whiff of the blogger. It is very much a very classic sort of memoir, and it's on, you know, a very reputable and recognized publisher. So I guess my question is, you know, how the heck does someone who has created so much just intense, harrowing, brazenly emotional music come about to write such a self-deprecatingly funny book? How did that happen?
Eric, there is no answer to that.
My first question.
Next. No. No, there really isn't a great answer to that. I mean, it is a little bit schizophrenic. I think when my editor first contacted me, when Eric first contacted me, he really expected a dark, harrowing, brazenly raw, whatever, novel. That's what he kind of asked for. He said, I like the sensibility of your music, and I think if you apply that to prose, you know, you could write a novel. And so, you know, we would get together and have tea and talk about my imaginary novel that I never wrote for him that was so harrowing and raw and passionate. And then, something like 10 months later, I gave him 10 pages that became the first chapter of this book. And, you know, just ultimately when I sat down to write, that was the voice I felt comfortable writing in. And I think that, you know, people are very different from the things they make. You know, you shouldn't confuse, you know, a person's personality for their art. You know, I've met a lot of artists who make funny art and are serious. You know, I think maybe that's more common, who are dead serious about their funny art, you know, and you can similarly, I can't do that in reverse, but you know what I mean? Like, so I think it's a very different outlet. I mean, to me, music is very physical. You know, it's a physical release. And the music that I love is music that moves me, that literally demands to be listened to, that cannot be played in the background, that makes you feel something. That's why music matters to me. But I like all kinds of writing, and I really do. I'm a bit of a book slut, so I like to read funny books, and I like to read, you know, Harry Potter. And I just finished John Krakauer's Into Thin Air about 12 years too late. Apparently, I keep telling everyone, I'm like, there's this great book, and they're like, yeah, it's a movie too. Why didn't anyone tell me? So that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, how were you convinced to feel like you could, you know, write this book? Did that take much convincing? Was that something that you sort of, you know, kind of had always had in the back of your mind? This is an avenue that I could broach?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that my editor really convinced me to write it. It took a long time to, because I had just released that Russian album and I was touring it, and I toured the US and Europe and a little bit in Russia even for that album. So I promoted it for about a year and a half, and he contacted me in the midst of that. And I think in part that's why I finally decided to write something trying to be as funny as I could be, because Yanka Diaghileva makes me look like Lucille Ball. I mean, her music is really depressing, and even I got depressed covering her after a while, and I needed to do something else, and I just needed to do a 180 and kind of get a breath of fresh air, and I got this opportunity. But my editor, I mean, it wasn't a heavily edited book in terms of like line editing, but in a psychological sense, you know, he was very important to me. It was really his encouragement. I wouldn't be a writer if it weren't for him. So it was, and what's funny about it is, like, in the music industry, I feel like this has all but disappeared, this notion of artist development. You know, the music industry used to have this where you know, someone who ran a label could literally pluck someone from obscurity. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't still happen somewhere, maybe it does, but definitely, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago, it happened a lot more, where someone would recognize talent and they would say, you know, maybe not your first album or even your second or your third, but we're going to stay with you because we believe in you as an artist and we want to nurture you and we want to help shape your career. And even in the indie world, I think that's happened to artists like Cat Power. I think Matador's been that label for her. If you listen to her first couple albums, they're very abrasive and punk and, you know, very, very different from where she is today. And I think that is thanks to artist development. And I think that I somehow, through some weird karmic justice, maybe, benefited a little bit from that in the literary world, because that's how it felt, at least.
In the process of writing, I mean, how different was this from writing a song, say, for example?
Oh, it was very different because songs are short. And I pointed that out to Eric when he suggested I write a book, because he's like, you have written things. And I'm like, I could fit the things I've written on 3 pages of paper, double spaced. I don't think that really qualifies me to write a book. But writing is, you know, I mean, you know, I want to say it's hard. I mean, it is hard. We're not Chilean coal miners. It's not that hard. It's, you know, it's... It's actually pretty cool work if you can get it.
Well, but what is hard, and that's clear from reading the book, is being a singer-songwriter and making a career out of that. Silly to say, but sum of that up. That experience, how has that sort of brought you to a point where then you can write a book and feel comfortable about that? Writing about the experience of going through it.
Well, I mean, what I found in writing about, you know, my experiences being a very DIY musician, there were things that I wanted to hide because they were very embarrassing, you know, and I wanted to sort of skim the surface of things. And what I found was that unless I really revealed those truly humiliating moments, unless I sort of brought the reader to a really scary place with me, then I couldn't get the comedic high that I wanted. I think you laugh harder when, you know, when there's some tragedy, and I mean, I think Woody Allen said that tragedy plus time equals comedy. Someone said that to me recently, so they might be here tonight, the person who said that. Anyways, so and I think that's true. I mean, the humorous writing that I like most, I mean, I feel like the term humor writing doesn't do it justice, because I think really funny writing has a lot of humanity in it. And that's what I tried to do. I really tried to reveal the totally icky things that happened to me from catching fleas. True. I am a person who's had fleas. And, you know, these encounters with producers and lawyers and people in the industry who were very discouraging. And I just try to be as honest as I can about that. And I thought that, you know, I think of it as a funny book, but I've had so many people come up to me and just go, I'm so sorry. You know, like, they feel so bad for me. I think my mom cried. Literally, she was like, I had no idea you had fleas. And I'm like, it wasn't that bad. It was just a little itchy. I'm okay.
Talk a little bit about your family, because they do play such a kind of a key role in the stories that you tell. What is sort of their reception to your music, and now what do they think about sort of the book?
You know, they were not into my music, I have to admit. I mean, they come from a very different culture, and they wanted me to achieve a kind of white-collar success that would ensure I had a stable income and a, you know, and a stable lifestyle, and they just really didn't understand all of this weird stuff I was doing. I'll say my dad is a kind of a spacey and strange man, and he was much more on my team than my mom, who's slightly insane and is like, she comes off as kind of like a lovable, you know, though harsh person, but you know, in real life she can be challenging. And so in real life she was challenging, and she was pretty discouraging. I mean, she just did not get it. But I will say that I put a little chart in the book. Can I see it?
Yes, absolutely.
Because I talk about when it turned around. There's a little, there's a beautiful little chart my friend Ben Coonley made for me. So I'm just going to read a section called Press. Press. The parents of most indie rockers do not necessarily endorse their life choices. They might wish their children were pursuing a career that offered more stability, more prestige, more money. Okay, any money. It can be a thorny situation. My advice? More fame. That's right. Rather than probing wounds that have been festering for decades in therapy, devote your energy to scoring some choice press. Even a short clipping from your college alumni magazine can go a long way toward winning mom's heart. And I'd say that's what happened to me. Like, I mean, as soon as I started getting a little press, and she kind of could see that, you know, I was making some headway, she got behind me in a big way. But, you know, there were five hard years there before that took place.
This chart is actually, I mean, should really be photocopied and delivered to every single struggling artist out there, because it really has all of the key components to it. However, except for one, and that is, I will speak for my own industry, and that is radio.
Oh, I missed radio. Whoops.
Missed radio.
Because radio never played me.
Well, okay, now that, well then talk about that. What are the aspects that you found really were most important to you as an artist when you were going around and doing this grind? What were the things that were most rewarding to you through that process?
What was the most rewarding? You know, I really like recording, to be honest. I mean, out of everything, like I like the act of making the thing. More than anything, I like the act of writing songs alone in my room. I really like the act of getting my band together or one or two members and having them over and, you know, showing them a new song and having them add their instrumentals and batting around ideas. I love that, and I love recording, especially if the producer's really talented, and I'm lucky to have worked with some great ones. And that is my hands-down favorite piece of the whole process.
Does that sort of apply similarly with the writing? It's great to then have a book published. It's the artifact that becomes sort of the reward at some level.
I think, well, you know, I think that the words on the page, when you know it's done, and even if it's just on your laptop, you know, it's a good feeling. I mean, I like to, you know, take pieces and read it to friends, and if they would laugh out loud, then, you know, that was very rewarding.
There's a chapter, an essay, talking about the time you were kind of touring around with Amanda Palmer, singer-songwriter as well, and this was sort of before she became pretty well known. And in talking about sort of the motivations to do this, and sort of one of the key words for her was to become an icon.
Yes.
What was that? Does that broach at all sort of your goals? Were you attempting to do you say the reward of being able to record something? Was it also, did you feel the desire to have a live audience to perform to? Was that a part of it?
I think I said in my book, my only desire was to be able to say I was a singer and not use air quotes. That remains true. I just don't be like, I'm a singer. So, I mean, Amanda, you know, she wanted to just, like, you know, take life by the balls and eat them or something. I mean, I can't believe I said that. I'm sorry. That's disgusting. She was very motivated from a very young age. I mean, we went to middle school together. I've known her since she was in sixth grade, and I was in eighth grade, and we met when she cast me in a role in a musical that she had written in sixth grade. And, you know, she was always very driven and always very talented. And And it was very intimidating. I mean, I had a couple of friends in high school who went on to become, you know, pretty famous. And it was both intimidating and inspiring because I didn't have that in me. I didn't have that thirst for recognition, for public recognition. And both of those folks, the other was Eugene Merman, comedian Eugene Merman, who also went to high school with us. Both of those folks loved to be in the spotlight. That really made them happy. They loved to perform. They felt at ease in front of people. And I was a total wallflower. I was never in any plays. I wasn't in chorus. I wasn't, you know, in the a cappella group. I don't know. You know, I didn't do sports. What did I do? I read books alone in my room. So that is why I was 28 when I made my first EP.
Well, how did you drag yourself on stage to be a performer then? How did that happen?
You know, I think you get to a point in your life, you just get to this crossroads where it's like you're going to either do what you dream of doing or at least attempt it or kind of live a bitter life of regret. And I came to that crossroads and it was really painful. I mean, you come to a point where you're like, you know, I kind of need to get a job, you know, or like I kind of need to, you know, pay my rent, you know, in a more efficient manner. And, you know, or I need to just go for it. And, like, you just accept that I'm going to kind of go off the grid and do something, attempt to achieve a career that has no clear pathway. And that's the really scary part. I mean, there's no, you know, trajectory. There's nothing that works. There's no plan. There's no program, you know, or application procedure. And you're raised, you go through school and you kind of get used to knowing how you can get from point A to point B. And the thing with trying to be an artist, you know, or a writer or a musician is that there is no guide. And that's really scary. And, you know, in my mid-20s, I just kind of realized that I was going to court mental illness if I didn't at least try. I mean, literally, I know it's being really melodramatic, but you can get very depressed when you hate yourself. So I decided to start singing on the street, which for me was easier than singing on a stage in front of people facing me like this. So I just stood in this little doorway on 6th Street in Austin, Texas. I think the place is called like Bill's Billiards now or something. And I just stood in this dark, but it was boarded up then. That was the beauty of it. So it was a boarded up place. And I stood in this dark little doorway and I, you know, had a little battery powered amp. And that's how I started, just to try to get over the fear. Because a lot of people say, oh, that's so scary. You started on the street, but that's so scary. And I'm like, have you ever been on the street? Like, people pee on the street, you know? Like, you can do anything on the street, really. Like, nobody cares. So I disagree with the notion that it's scary to do things on the street. That was a tangent. I mean, in New York, they don't even turn the other way when they pee, you know? It's just like, here I am, you know?
In terms of, you know, when you say you kind of reached this point where you decided, hey, I'm just going to have to go for it, were there some models that you had, not necessarily in terms of somebody that did it in that fashion, but rather the whose music was the inspiration for your art?
Well, you know, Mary Lou Lord was a big inspiration, and most people don't know who she is, but she for many years she was a busker in Boston, and she played at the Park Street Stop and at Government Center, and I went to high school when she was busking at Park Street, and I had to switch at that station, and I would just sit there for an hour, you know, and be late for everything just to listen to her. And she went on to sign to a major label. Actually, she signed to Sony for a while, and she had some, you know, minor hits and some success, and she's back to busking now, I hear, in Boston. But she was super inspirational because she was clearly not like Amanda, not like sort of my other example. She was clearly kind of a shy girl with a very sweet personality who was just out there expressing herself and really being herself. And everyone on the subway platform would just fall in love with her. It would just be silent. And then, you know, some like really tough, grizzled, you know, guy would yell down the platform, like, sing it again, Blondie, you know, in some really thick Boston accent, and it would be awesome. And so I just loved watching her, and I loved what she was doing, and, you know, that was, like, a huge inspiration, because she was, like, just a real person. And I was like, oh, a real person can do this. I have a chapter in my book where I kind of talk about growing up in the 80s and watching these huge rock stars. You kind of felt like, you had to go from 0 to 60. There was like nothing in between. Like you, there was like you in your bedroom singing a song, and there was Madonna, and then there was some like vast space in between. You had no idea what filled that void, if anything. You know, you never saw, like, at least where I lived in the suburbs. There were no clubs, there was no live music, there was nothing. And so, you know, I really thought the way it happened was, there was a room somewhere and you like auditioned and then someone was like, yeah, I'm going to make you Madonna. You know, you're impressive. So, so Mary Lou Lord was like my first real live example of a person who was, you know, neither me nor Madonna, but something in the middle and something I could actually be.
Right. You mentioned about, touring internationally. I'm curious to hear about touring in Russia. I mean, did you play extensively throughout Russia or?
I went on, no, I've had some offers to tour a little more extensively in Russia, and I have not said yes to those. I did a little tour that was Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Arkhangelsk, which is in the Arctic Circle. Yes, if you're passing through, I recommend the club Kolyaso. So I did that, and I have family in St. Petersburg, so every time I go to St. Petersburg, I play shows there. So I've played in St. Petersburg a bunch of times, and I've played Moscow a bunch of times, like not on tour, but sort of one-off things. And, you know, and it's really funny because it's just sort of like playing here, like in Los Angeles. You'd think like, oh, you know, like it's going to be on the steppe in a yurt. I don't know. You know, you think I'm going to... potatoes will be served. I don't know, you just think it'll be really Russian, and in truth it's just like a really modern club with like, you know, indie rock people that have a, you know, who are Russian.
Is indie rock the universal language? Is that what we learn?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. That's reassuring. Speak a little bit about Yonka and how you kind of came to her music and how that spoke to you and what compelled you to do a record of her work.
Well, I first found out about her from some buskers in Brighton Beach in New York. I just struck up a conversation with some folks that were singing Russian songs on the street in Brighton Beach, and I had never heard sort of indie punk sounding, very contemporary sounding Russian music. I'd heard the folk music my parents played at home, and that was the Russian music that I was familiar with. And I could immediately tell that this was something subcultural, and I knew nothing about subculture in the Soviet era. So I started talking to them, and they invited me to go to a Russian rock show later, and they gave me a tape, a mixtape they made of Yonka. And I immediately fell in love with it. And maybe part of it was just because you always think to yourself, as an immigrant, you think, what would have happened if I stayed? What would have happened if my family didn't leave the Soviet Union? And so maybe I felt a little bit of a connection with her because she was clearly... she was clearly an unusual girl. She was following her heart. She was expressing her music in her own terms. And... I actually doubt that I would have done that if I stayed in Russia. I would have just like worn a lot of makeup and become an engineer because that's what you do. But she issued that path, and she did something I consider very courageous, which is, you know, she lived her life exactly the way she wanted to live it, even though it was completely not accepted by society at that time. Even the way she dressed. I mean, she just. You know, she didn't wear makeup or high heels. She wore boots and pants, and she didn't wear makeup. And she traveled. She crisscrossed the Soviet Union by train, often by herself. She played very unofficial venues. You know, most of the time, just people's apartments. So, because that's what she really wanted to do, and very sadly, she did that for only 4 years. Her career only lasted 4 years before she. Most people suspect she killed herself. She drowned. But I think that mostly her music struck me, like the melody struck me. It struck me on a musical level. It wasn't like just her biography. I mean, when I heard the music, I loved the music. And then when I learned more about her, I decided this was a project I really wanted to tackle, and that it was important to me that it be released in the United States because I realized that people have never heard anyone sing in Russian. People don't know anything about Russian music, and I thought that it would be cool to kind of put that out there, put that in the mix, because it can be very homogenous. You know, indie rock can be very, you know, very American and always sung in English, and traveling around and touring in Europe, I would see bands from all these different countries singing in English and never in their own language. And they sounded usually not necessarily that great singing in English, because they believed that that was like the language of indie rock. And when I heard this great indie rock in Russian, I decided I don't want to change it. I want to sing it in Russian. It's meant to be sung in Russian, and it would not sound good translated.
Did you know enough Russian to know the lyrics, the translation of the lyrics when you first heard it?
You know, her lyrics are extremely hard to understand even to native Russians because it's surrealist poetry, and so it's not like it has necessarily a literal meaning. It's more just these fragments. It's very hallucinatory, and it's beautiful. So it's like I understand the occasional fragments, but could I explain what it's all about? No. It's beautiful, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I do translate the lyrics in the... I mean, my friend Collins is here somewhere. There he is. He translated the lyrics, actually, for the Yanka record, and I think it might have even been the first time that those lyrics had been translated into English. Yeah. So.
Well, I mean, you know, at some level, that's a great service to bring that music to everybody, as well as just being a great record on its own right. And I will say, also, in the book, there's really a beautiful... sort of graphic novel segment that gives a little bit of her biography.
And that's actually an L.A. artist, Vladimir Zimakov, who did those carvings, and he's incredible.
Oh, it's terrific. Talk about the title, You Must Go and Win. It's sort of the final section of the book. You talk about, is the phrase indie rock suicide? Is that what the phrase is? Where you're sort of mulling over the notion of quitting the music business?
I did mull the notion of indie rock suicide. I was pulled back from the brink, though, Eric, which is why I'm here today.
Thank heavens.
But You Must Go and Win, yeah, it's something that actually a mutual friend of mine in Konz said to me when I was being very whiny. I had to play a tiny show on a Wednesday night, and it was, you know, it was bitterly cold. It was like, February, and I had been parked on the couch with a Netflix and was perfectly happy. and I knew that no one was going to be there because no one came. In that sense, it was wonderful to have someone like that who really cared about each chapter. I owe him a lot.
What is the more torturous process, putting together an album's worth of songs or writing a book of this type?
I mean, for me, I think because I had been making music for so long, it just comes more naturally. So I kind of know what to do, and I feel a lot more confident in my impulses. Whereas with the book, I didn't. You know, I felt like it was nice to have that editor because I could ask and say, is this working? I mean, I like it, but, you know, so...
Any other questions? Question over here? Over there? Over here?
But I pointed at that man first, and now I feel committed to this nice man.
Okay.
I'm just curious. Did you feel a difference in the flow of writing between songs? Sometimes, you know, a lot of times you hear songwriters say, the song just wrote itself. Was there a different flow, like some days, I know you always have writer's block, or people probably do, but did you sense a different flow between writing a book, a chapter, versus a song as far as ideas just coming, or?
I mean, I think it's similar in the sense that you have good days and bad days, and some days, you know, like you can just write an entire song and it's great, and you know, and then go for months with a dry spell where you can't write anything. I think I really do believe in having like epiphanies and having those great days and having those like spurts. That's a gross word. I hate that word. Spurts of, you know, inspiration. And I also came to believe in the importance of writing every day and establishing a routine, because I just felt like I got better and better the more I wrote. And if you just kind of force yourself to do that you'll see a difference. I don't know how this turned into a class. Sorry.
There's one there.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you, your father, he was recruited by the KGB. What kind of skills?
He refused recruitment by the KGB, but he was asked.
What kind of skills would he have, or somebody of his age that they would be looking for?
You know what's funny is my dad would make the worst KGB agent. Like, he suffered so much for turning them down, but I wish that I could have just, like, taken those people aside and been like, this guy would have sucked. Like, he would not have, you know, found your enemies and destroyed them at all. Like, my dad is a really nice, quiet, little scientific man. But he knew English well, and he was a physicist. And so I think that sparked their interest. So.
Final question over here.
Do you have any interest in writing anything fiction or possibly screenplays? Because I read an interview that you did about your interest in film.
I did. I wrote a screenplay. That was the first thing I wrote when I finished the book, and I'm halfway through a novel. Because, I mean, there's a very long lag between when you finish a book and when it actually comes out. So, you know, I had a year to hang out. So that's what I did. And it was really freeing to turn to fiction, and I hadn't really realized kind of what a constraint the truth can be. I mean, I love the truth. I'm a big fan of truth. There is no James Frey action going on here, I swear to you. But it's also fun to make shit up, so it was really nice to, after trying really hard to be faithful to events while still being entertaining, you know, because there's a tension there. You don't want to be, you know, you want to tell the truth, but you also want to be funny, and so, or, you know, whatever, I wanted to be funny. So it was very freeing to turn to fiction and just to be able to let my imagination run wild and be funny however I wanted to be funny, whether, you know, it was based on anything or not. I highly recommend it. I bet you in L.A. have tried it at home.
I admit. Will you play us a final song?
Yes.
Okay. Folks, also, just to let you know, we will be hanging out afterwards, and so we hope that you can join us for that, as well as a reminder that to support your local libraries, there'll be somebody there that you can talk to become a member and support the great institution that a library is. So please stick around for that. Ladies and gentlemen, Alina Simone.
Eric, don't forget your mug.
So we're doing this mic. So I'd never do this. But because I'm in LA, I'm going to do the song karaoke style. And it's based on a chapter in my book. But, you know, I like to support emerging singer-songwriters and kind of promote the work of lesser-known artists. So I thought that it would be cool to do, you know, one more cover. And I also really miss my band, because my album and my music in general, I have a band, and they're amazing. And my songs are actually very lushly orchestrated, or this new album is, and so I get to bring them here in the form of an MP3. I think I did it again. I made you believe we're more than just friends. Oh, baby, baby, it might seem like a crush, but it doesn't mean that I'm serious. 'Cause to lose all of my senses is just so typically me. You see, my problem is this: I'm dreaming away, wishing that heroes, they truly exist. I cry watching the days. Can't you see I'm a fool in so many ways? But to lose all of my senses is just so typically me. Oh, baby, baby, you made me think I'm
but I am not that innocent.
Loud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.